Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I speak to Digby Summerhill, and if that name doesn't ring too much of a bell to you, that's for pretty good reason. Digby keeps quite a low profile. He's not some famous hedge fund manager or super investor or anything like that, but he is a UK-based business person. He's the managing director these days of his family company, and he's also a private investor. He invests his own money and some family money these days as well, in a long-term value investing style that will be familiar to many of the people who follow this podcast. I first met Digby actually in Omaha, Nebraska back in 2022 when I was over there for the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. We got talking and I found that Digby had a really interesting story. He managed to dramatically turn around his family business. He was kind of thrown into managing it a few years ago and discovered that it was in pretty bad shape. It had a couple million pounds of debt. Kind of every day that he would come into the office, he would find something new that was going wrong with the business. Even some really dramatic stuff like significantly misfiled tax returns that they then had to, you know, go to the government and say, you know, we owe you more money. We don't have the money. We want to pay you. We need to figure out a plan. And they were incredibly stressful times that kind of Digby was thrown into, but he managed to pull the business out the other side. And we kind of cover that story in this episode. Additionally, on the investing side, Digby is a very passionate investor in his own right, and actually just recently completed a trip to Turkey to visit a number of companies where he was looking for kind of deep value, long-term investment opportunities as well. Some of you may have heard on previous episodes of the podcast, particularly with Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor, you may have heard us joking about this high-level person who was kind of on the ground in Turkey. Jason was getting these late-night phone calls from someone in Turkey with, you know, information about these companies and various things. That high level person we were joking about is actually Digby. So just in case you were ever wondering kind of who we were talking about there and who was going around and visiting all these different management teams at Turkish businesses, that was Digby, and he'll share some experiences from those visits in this episode too. Now, as always, anytime we talk about individual stocks on one of these podcast episodes, it is not investment advice. It's not intended to be a recommendation or anything like that. Rather, it's just kind of situations we find interesting that you may want to dig into a little more. Digby had a great line a couple of times in this podcast where he said, you know, when people say do your own research, that's not a disclaimer. I suppose it is a disclaimer, but his view is it's not a disclaimer. It's in fact an instruction, and for you to be comfortable with investing long term and anything, you should certainly know what you're getting into. So just want to reinforce that before we get into the podcast episode around some of the individual stocks that are mentioned. And also Digby does mention a specific Turkish fund in this episode as well. So just for full transparency and disclosure, I actually do know some of the people who run that fund. Matthew Peterson has been a previous guest on this podcast, but I have no business or investment kind of relationship with the fund mentioned. Again, for full disclosure, it is mentioned in the episode, but Digby's family does have an investment with the fund that's mentioned. But again, it's not a recommendation. Please do your own due diligence and your own research before making any investment decisions. And one final thing I'll say is Digby does share some pretty personal stories in this episode. And he also talks about a few points in time where he was really struggling with his own mental health. So I just want to put that at the start of the episode here as a bit of a pre-warning for people as well. But with that introduction out of the way, let's roll this episode with Digby Summerhill, and I hope you enjoy. Digby, welcome to what I assume is your very first podcast appearance. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but welcome along. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, you're right. This definitely is. And for anyone that ever watches these things and has no idea how hard it is to get things like microphones and cameras set up, I sent Tom a funny picture the other day when somebody lent me some equipment and I was like, oh, this is actually a lot harder than just plug in and play. So yeah, learning curve already.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm very excited to have you on the podcast. I put up a very mysterious tweet the other day with like a sort of silhouette figure of a businessman who I thought actually resembled you pretty well, to try and collect some questions for the episode around Turkish stocks. But I also want to dive into quite a few other topics in the episode. But I think for the audience, maybe just chat briefly through how we actually met each other in the first place and why we're able to do this podcast, because I think that's a cool story in its own right.
Yeah. So we met in person in Omaha in 2022 at a famous pre-venue before the Saturday. I actually reached out to you because I knew that you were going, but it was actually triggered by one of the podcasts with Guy Spier, where he said, you know, if this is what you commit to and, you know, this is what you're interested in. You know, it's like Mecca for value investing. And you should go once in your life. And I thought, well, these guys are pretty old. COVID's just happened. And it was kind of like a commitment. And he said, you meet a lot of like-minded people. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to do this, right? I should do this. I've been reading about this and all of these things, and I should go and do that. So I reached out via email to you, and you came back and you said, yeah, well, Guy Spier's doing this thing. Do you want to meet up there? And then, accidentally we met the day before, at a different event. Yes. But it was really great. And, I don't know, how did you find Omaha? I found those events almost more fulfilling or more valuable than the Saturday, and that's not to discount listening to Warren and Charlie live, but you can watch that online, a different ambience granted, but you don't get everything else. I don't know how that was for you.
Yeah, for sure. The mysterious event you're mentioning, just for people's reference, was Matthew Peterson's barbecue, the Berkshire Backyard barbecue where we met. So for sure, I've said it a few times on different videos and podcasts and stuff, but the amount of surrounding events kind of around the Berkshire weekend, that surprised me just how many of those events there are. And they were definitely the highlight, sort of, the people you meet, rather than actually kind of sitting down for the content from or the Q&A session with Warren and Charlie. Cause like you say, you can watch that online.
Yeah. But even standing in line, right? I mean, so you met Brett last year standing in line. KPG actually had a shareholders event this year that I went to, that was great. And even the other people that were there. So Jake Taylor was there as well for a while. And you're like, and everybody's very approachable and very generous, you know. I always, this year I worried that whilst I was there, people would realize I'm a fraud and I'm an idiot and I have nothing to add. And there are all these, you know, really smart people. And I'm just sort of listening into the conversations going, wow, this is insane. The information that I'm able to absorb here. No pun intended in investing land, but probably the best investment I've made in myself, that airfare, that hotel for a long time. The things that happened as a result, there are two people that I'm in contact with almost daily that I met there and who came with me to Turkey. And we just, that shared passion, and they're way smarter. I don't know why they include me in the group. but they're certainly always sharing great ideas and giving great reflections on their points of view, or telling me why it's a terrible idea that I've just sent them, which is really useful, very valuable.
Yeah, for sure. I recall when we met, you told me a bit of kind of your story of your family business and how you kind of got interested in investing and so on. And I'm pretty sure I said in passing, I'm not sure if you remember this, but I'm pretty sure I said in passing at the barbecue, I might have to get you on the podcast one day. Don't know if you recall that, but I'm glad we finally got you here, because this should be a good
one. Yeah, I remembered something like that. And I said, oh, I don't think anybody would ever want to hear about my family business and, you know, going through shit and trying to make it work. It's just an SME. But I do think that some of those things have helped me in my investment journey. I certainly still mess things up from time to time in business and in investing, but I think it certainly helped.
Well, tell us a little bit about, I guess, a bit about your background, the business that you are kind of in day to day now, and how you got into this whole business and investing world.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a big talker, so if I go on, let me know. So my family in the Netherlands, my mother's Dutch, my father's British, have been making furniture for over 150 years. When my parents got married, my father was just an accountant. He used to travel around in England to different companies and just helping them with their weekly or monthly accounts. And my grandfather said, well, here's a catalogue of our furniture in the Netherlands. Every time you see a furniture shop or you drive by one, drop off a catalogue. If they place an order for their display or to a customer, I'll give you a small commission. And quite soon, my father realized that he was able to earn a lot more money selling these tables, it was mainly tables, as kind of an agent to furniture shops of this slightly new contemporary, you know, European furniture than he was out of his day job. So they then started a small business, just basically importing that from their home. And then they started to gather other brands, first all Dutch ones and then more European ones. And as a child, I remember, well, my mum tells me that I went to trade shows when I was just a few weeks old in like the baby seat, sat on a cabinet, or that I remember being given like a bunch of coins to go to the phone booth, and my mother would sit in the kitchen like his receptionist, and they would pretend our house was a show home, and I would phone from the phone booth so it would appear like he was very busy. Like, oh, I'm sorry, you know, John's just in a meeting with a client now, and the person in the meeting had this impression, you know. So my parents were very much like that. We didn't have a lot when I was younger, but the business grew, and we started to assemble more brands, and obviously I worked. As a kid, I would help make the binders on the weekends for my dad. I used to cut, you know, leather and fabric samples on the weekends. So I kind of grew up with it. But ironically, I hated it because I grew up with it. I was like completely disinterested, which is ridiculous, really. And when I was young, we couldn't even afford to fix the car because all the money went back into the business. Like, I think the exhaust was leaking. I used to have to hang my head out the window on the drive to school. And like friends wouldn't want to come home and fly because they were like, oh, that guy, like, don't go to those people's house. But then when I was a teenager, you know, growing up, my fortunes picked up and I actually have had quite a privileged upbringing. You know, I've been to university, good schooling, a lot of nice things. And I discovered a passion for skiing, and, you know, skiing's not a cheap hobby. So much so that I was the first person in my family to go to university, and I studied leisure and hospitality. I was never a very studious, I was the gazing out the window kind of student, and I didn't like reading. And then I went off to be a ski instructor, which was my real passion. I loved it. I've been to New Zealand, which is a thankless job. You can earn more money or the same money standing in a checkout, or you can try and corral 8 to 10 children in like sideways pelting hail. So if you ever go skiing in New Zealand, tip your instructor, because they're doing it for love. Anyway, so that was great. I was living, that was all fantastic. And then unfortunately my father developed dementia. And by this time we had stopped doing a lot of the furniture. We'd kind of focused in on one brand that we'd really run, was a runway success, had become a very big, well-established brand, and we had the exclusive distribution rights in the UK. And my mother said, oh, can you help? Because she doesn't know anything about accounting or anything. And, you know, I'd done some university. I mean, I didn't study accounting or anything like that, but I had some grasp of, you know, money in, money out. And I kind of thought I could do that part-time because I was, you know, living the dream in the Alps and doing all of those things. And I did that for about one winter. And as I came into spring, it became more and more clear that there were more and more problems. And as my father's dementia, he couldn't recall things. He would even make up things to fill in the blanks. And that's when I realized that we were actually hugely in debt and very much behind on paying suppliers, and more stuff came out of the woodwork. It's a small business, right? So not everything is documented. So when somebody suddenly says, hang on, you haven't paid me an invoice in 6 months, that's when you find out that's the, you know, the accounting my dad had often done a lot of himself as well. And we just had a bookkeeper. So sort of unpicking that took some time. And then I came into the business full time and I didn't realize it immediately, but sort of by the end, at one point, we were about £1.5 million in debt. And that includes, you know, debts to suppliers and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, with, you know, days of cash left. And, you know, I remember, you know, using personal credit cards, just swiping them through the card machine to put money on the account so that we could make payroll on time for our employees. Because I couldn't figure out, nobody would give me a loan. I wasn't on top of the books. It was all a mess. Yeah, that's how I came to be the director of our family family business.
At the time,
it felt like a poison chalice at the time.
Yeah. Were you, just for a bit of context, this is only within the past few years, right? You can maybe tell us.
2016, 2017, yeah.
Yeah, and were you sort of in the like a whole Buffett, Munger value investing kind of world at this time, or was...
No. I did, by some good fortune, when I was a student, my student finance, the loan got paid out twice in 2004. And I was so worried that I would get drunk and spend it on girls or drinks. And you could still access your savings account. But ABN AMRO, I studied in the Netherlands, you could set up if you're a student, free stocks and shares. And I was like, oh, that's good, because I can't touch it on the weekend. Only when the market's open can I get my money out. And I had first or second generation iPod. And I was like, this is so much better, hey? And just chucked it in Apple and forgot about it, which, you know, is blind luck. There was no analysis. There was nothing. Yeah. There was, you know, it was pure... you know, good fortune that happened. But it did mean that, and we'll come to this a bit later, when things were going better in the business, I had an appreciation of how the right choice, you know, if there was a way to make that choice intelligently, and simply leaving it for a long time could really do wonderful things. So, in fact, unfortunately, I sold my Apple shares at the start of 2020. Partially because of COVID, but I was trying to buy a flat with my partner Rebecca. Mm-hmm. I've tried not to look at the chart too much since.
I did really well.
I have nothing to complain about. But I was not in the Buffett Munger. I had an interest during the 2008-2009 meltdown. I was on my phone again in the ABN AMRO. I was buying turbos and speedies, which are highly leveraged instruments. In gold and all kinds of things. And I was like, oh my God,
right.
I just made 900 euros, which is a student. And then I subsequently lost it. And this was a pure speculation, gambling, no intelligent, trying to guess macro, you know, doing all the things that actually today I look at and I think, God, if only at that time I had an interest in red, a little bit, how different things would be. I wasn't in that train of thought, but it was later as things started to get a bit better. But yeah, so we were just in the, not sure if we can share, swear, but it was a really crap place. And, you know, we still had outgoings. So my whole family lives from the business, right? So my father's ability for care, my sister was at university in the States. You know, my mother paying, you know, her expenses and just, you know, everything was coming from that. And they were still in their old spending habits from when they thought things were going well. And my father had actually hidden this to a certain degree. He'd filed his taxes wrong. I had the government coming saying, you owe us money. We're going to come and confiscate assets, really, really hard. And I was desperately trying to scramble money together. And I was, robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, if you ever want a list of excuses as to why you haven't paid an invoice on time, come to me. I've got them all. And then some. So it was super hard. In fact, it could almost be a comedy. You know, we've got this money coming out and I'm like almost being the parent, cutting up my mum's and dad's credit cards, saying what are you doing? And just desperately trying to arrest the spending, both personally and of the business, cutting back everything. And then doing a very simple break-even point analysis and realizing, because we were so panicked, all of the salespeople were just everybody knew that we needed cash, so people were just discounting. So our margins were really small. And I came to this very sobering conclusion that our break-even point with these suppressed margins, because we were just racing to get any cash in the door, would mean that we would have to sell three times more than we'd ever sold, which didn't seem like a likely prospect. No. And so we had this conversation with the sales team and saying look, so this is impossible. So we have to try to stop panicking. And I realized that we needed more time. So I just went and tried to borrow money. You find out who your family friends are really quickly when you're not asking, you're begging, when you have days left. And if not, it's curtains. It's really, But it's also wonderful. At the time, it was awful. It was very difficult emotionally. I would wake up crying in the night. I would cry walking to work because I didn't know what to do. There was like all of these problems, like, you know, cash, not enough sale, like letters, people wanting to, you know, repossess stuff but it's wonderful if somebody puts a metaphorical gun to your head. The clarity that it brings, you see through everything and you know intrinsically exactly what has to happen, and you're able to, my output of loan applications and ability to hustle in that moment, I don't think I'll ever be able to reproduce that high level of output of work. And I got rejected over and over and over. I think I told you before this call, last Sunday, the Farnham Street newsletter, really recommend it for anyone that hasn't. It's very small bite size. And they wrote, the difference between success and failure is often just one more rep, one more attempt, trying one more time. And I think when I got that first loan, that couldn't be truer. And the terms were horrendous. £210,000 over 18 months, £380,000 to repay, bullet payment, no interim payment. So I actually wanted the deal because it meant cash flow for 18 months. I wasn't paying anything back. I had breathing space. And it just got everyone, it got a few other people off my back short term. I negotiated a pay deal with the government on the back taxes. Showed them in good faith that I was trying to do that. There was also on that loan, because it was a bullet payment, but it was also convertible, so they would take 70% of the shares of the business if I failed. And then I had to refinance that because actually I couldn't make it. I've signed personal guarantees. I've taken the money. I hope Rebecca doesn't watch this because she told me not to. I took the money that we saved for our flat, which included her money and mine from before the business, and I put it into the business. I didn't pay myself for 3 months because I knew I just needed more time. I could feel it. I hired more salespeople, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was doing a lot of the things that Charlie and Warren talk about. You know, show me the incentive, I show you the outcome. So I just said to my sales team and the whole company, I said, you know what? You want us to pay, and this is a team of 12, right? Said, how would you all like £5,000 in 9 months' time? Which is, you know, you could buy a secondhand car or, you know, before COVID, probably a secondhand Rolex even. Said, just do this number, right? As a company, we do this number, no questions asked, everybody, all equal. It's incredible how those kind of things really help focus the mind of everyone. And it's so simple, right? It's so simple. Yeah. And every week we talked about it. We had a meeting. This is how much we sold. This is how far we have to go. And there were a few criteria. The business must be profitable. We need a minimum margin of X, you know, and hit this number. And if you go past it, for every 100,000 over, I will top everybody's check up by £100. No limit. The sky's the limit. And we hired more salespeople because, you know, sometimes it's shit or bust. Yeah. You know, you get, now I never want to roll the dice like that again. I sleep well at night. But as I told you before, I get nervous when I go assess companies, I don't like impressive lobbies. I like impressive balance sheets and strong cash flow. Which is ironic because I sell expensive furniture for fancy lobbies. So that generates the funds. But we definitely had some difficult times. And actually, just as I thought I was getting on top of it, I was going through some historical accounts because I was trying to raise more funds and trying to show the history and clean up our accounts. And I discovered more faulty tax submissions. And the crazy thing is, like from 3-4 years ago, and I was like, no, I just want clean books. I don't want this kind of skeleton in the closet. I know about it, what happens, and you know, I should just be honest and straight and declare this. And the people were completely miffed. I wrote them a letter and say, look, I owe you another £132,000. And they said, you can't send us that letter. You filed these accounts, they're signed. And I said, well, the man that signed those accounts has a mental health issue. He's not in a fit state of mind. So I know that they're signed and they're submitted. So then they'd wanted to do a full-scale investigation and an audit of like everything, which was like And it's crazy, right? I'm coming to them saying, like, there's a mistake here. So they wanted to do that. And we went all through that. And then to add to it, I was like, and I don't have the money. but I, you know, I'm coming to you. I want to make this right. And for anyone that's a business owner in the UK and has any issues with VAT or HMRC, they send you a lot of threatening letters. But actually, when they came in and I thought they were going to start taking stuff away or close us down, if you are on top of your figures and if you have a solid, credible plan to pay them back, and they'll hate me for saying this, they will usually try to work out a plan because, you know, they want to collect the revenue, but also they won't charge you interest on it. So actually that was a godsend because I effectively had an interest-free loan for, you know, 9 months. So all of these things together, and I think that it's like baking a cake, right? You need to get all the ingredients and then you can get a fabulous cake. I just didn't have the recipe. I was trying to work it out as I went. And I would say to anyone that's in a situation that is like that, that is difficult, there are no books. You know, when it feels like you're trying to carry water in your hands from the sea and it's just, it feels hopeless. I think I got this from Batman. I think I told you, I have this framed on my desk and I used to chant it on my way to work. You know, the night is darkest just before the dawn, because every day it felt like I was going down and down and I would find something else. And it was like, I'm falling into the abyss. But if you just keep pushing through, one more rep, one more effort, one more day, if you can, you know, like Buffett and Charlie say in investing, don't get kicked out of the game. Just stay in the game. And that's actually the most important thing, so that you can keep playing. Find a way. I think that's a really powerful idea. It's also much easier said than done. I don't know if I would have had that resolve within me if my whole family did not depend on the outcome. I'm also a father now. You want motivation to really focus the mind. Taking on some responsibility like that that's a lot bigger than yourself really sharpens your focus, which I'm sure you're aware of too, Tom, having recently become a dad. But there were definitely, I'm not ashamed to say it now, but there were days when I stood on the platform and I watched the train coming and I thought, could I make this look like an accident? Because it was hard. I didn't want to disappoint my parents or my family and let them down. But I couldn't always see the way out. And now I'm in a wonderful place. I'm so fortunate. I sleep wonderfully at night. The business is doing well. And I think it's important because we often, you know, we talk about entrepreneurs or business leaders and it always seems like it was all great and easy and went wonderfully.
Yeah, for sure.
My journey was not like that. And I actually suffered, my mental health suffered as a result. Not when it was hard, just as I started to get on top of the debts. And I try to be quite frugal. But I said to my mum, as a family, we all love skiing. So let's book a chalet together. Let's all go, and not a cheap one, you know, which is unlike me. And it was Christmas just before that. And I just kind of had a burnout, like something went wrong whilst I was cooking. And it just, that was the, just fell on the floor. I was like, oh, what's happening? I kind of felt like I was coming out of my, it was bizarre. You know, really, really strange, you know, fit, healthy 30-year-old. We were speaking about the gym before. I go to the gym a lot. That probably helped me a lot. Even if you don't feel like it, even if you can't lift the weights that you normally do, go through the motions, just do it. You know, do something that you control and you can feel good about. But yeah, that happened and I had to take some time to talk to someone. But what was interesting is my mind would not allow that to happen until we were in a more stable place. And I think I kept pushing it away. It's like, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to make it work. And I didn't want to burden my partner, Rebecca, with quite how worried I was at times. And she's amazing. You know, when I was suffering with burnout and a bit depressed, and there was no way that I'm the easiest partner to have been around at that time. And she just took that on the chin, you know, newborn at home, sleep deprived. I'm incredibly lucky that she was always there for me. And now I'm also quite open to talk about those challenges and it's okay. At the time, I wasn't. That's all quite down. But there's a great ending, and I hope it's going to keep being a wonderful story in the future. And that is that if you keep persevering, if you ask for help, people fell over themselves to give me advice. It's following it that can be hard. And once I got, you know, things started to get better, I retained that thrifty, frugal mindset. And I'm glad to say that in 2017, I was £1.5 million in debt with days of cash flow left. And, you know, I've written personal guarantees on my apartment, which I wasn't supposed to, you know, and all kinds of things to get loans through. And recently I was offered to sell the business for, €3 million. And if somebody had offered me that even a few years ago, I would have ripped their arm off for that deal. It would have been like God himself reaching down from the heavens. And today I said, no, you're undervaluing it, and I don't think that that's the right number. And I'm having too much fun doing this now. I really enjoy it. And it's ironic because I never liked the business, the furniture business. But I think going through that adversity, I felt like I learned a lot. And I became really passionate about doing things right, about growing it and about seeing how far we can go. You know, my dad started this, and from very humble beginnings, he left school at 14. No degrees, no A levels, no O levels, which is what you get at 16. And I don't have a traditional education in business, but I think I've learned a few things in the last few years. I should actually shout out, there's Ben Horowitz wrote the only book that I found even remotely useful, which is about technology, which is, I think it's The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. And it's about technology and stuff, but basically it's when everything's shit. And he kept going through and like almost crashing, and then reinventing it and having to lay off staff. And there were not so much direct lessons, but the idea that other people have gone through that, and it's hard and you're just always fighting to keep going, super, super valuable. Ask for help. It doesn't matter if people won't lend you money, just keep asking. You'll find someone. They'll give you terrible terms like me. But
yeah, someone will do it.
But if someone, you just need to find one person that will take the other side. And a lot of the time I didn't know what to do because it was hard. So I just, you know, make it 1% better today. You know, just don't collapse in the office, you know, give the staff confidence. And renegotiate the phone contracts, the energy bill, win a client. It doesn't matter. Do anything that just makes it 1% better. That's either cutting costs or bringing in revenue, right? Or expanding the team that's going to bring in revenue. Or think about an incentive or a way that, you know, we did cost saving incentives. If anybody in the company can think about a way, you know, I read it somewhere. I stole the idea from somebody else or cloned it or whatever you want. You know, if you find a way for the company to save £1,000, I will split that saving with you. I will give you £500 in the first year, right? Suddenly loads of people had great ideas how we could save money.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, my contribution to the success of the business is 10% at best. And that's if I'm really rating myself highly. Most of it was just finding the right people. And just letting them, that, you know, and incentivizing them in the right way. And I think my 10% is just the perseverance to keep trying, not to chuck the towel in when other people might have folded. And market forces were kind to me. You know, there are no two ways about it. I have been incredibly lucky. I'm sure there are lots of people that had the grit and carried on pushing and it didn't work out because they just weren't lucky. You know, I think that nobody should discount luck from this. You know, I was born lucky from the start, right? I got to be the director of, okay, admittedly a company in trouble. There's nothing to do with my skill or my background. It's purely that I'm my parents' son. And I'm very aware that that's a you know, a golden ticket that I got from birth to have that opportunity and to have this learning experience. And through going all of that shit, I'm sorry, I'm swearing. I hope it doesn't demonetize your feed or anything. But I got into reading as well, business books and stuff, and you know, obviously investing. And I love the investing books because what do you look for in a great company is also a great way to what should my company do? What should my company look like to an outsider? And what are great characteristics that I can implement in my business? And I realized that some of them, like these incentives and things like that, were there. We're a family business. We have a long-term view. You know, today I'm fortunate enough to say I don't care about this quarter. You know, there was a time when I really did about the money, the cash coming in.
Yeah.
Cared about yesterday and tomorrow.
Yeah.
But now I can take a more holistic view. Well, what's good for us in 5 years, 10 years? What are those decisions? And I'm very, very lucky. And I don't carry any debt. You know, I think I stole that Peter Lynch's book. It's hard to go bust if you don't have any debt. And I don't intend to go bust. I don't intend to ever depend on the kindness of others again, because it's not a happy place, Tom. And I sleep wonderfully at night now. I would say like a baby, but as dads, we know that that's not true. Babies don't sleep very well at night. I sleep like a log, as long as my children don't wake me up. Well, my son woke me up this morning at 5 a.m., but again, Rebecca, being the superstar that she is, took him because she knows that I'm, had some stuff on today. And she's like, no, it's okay. She does that pretty much all of the time. The idea that I spend a lot of time at night with my kids is actually more my imagination. They wake me up, but Rebecca is the trooper there. She's always stepping in.
Very cool. Well, I want to, Digby, first off, super appreciate you sharing that. I'm sure a lot of the people listening in will as well. And I want to get into some of the success stories in the business soon as well, because I think you got some cool ones to share there, or at least details of them. We'll get into that in a sec. But tell us about, you know, we were on a call a couple of days ago, kind of prepping for this episode, and you told me some interesting stuff about just kind of getting through each day in the really hard times. Like, just you mentioned just trying to make the business a little bit better each day. Like, you mentioned renegotiating the phone contracts and things just before, and presumably through all of this there was like this there must have been a fairly overwhelming sense of belief that you could actually like pull through the other side of this thing if you just kept going. Can you talk to us about those couple of things?
Yeah, sure. So the overriding belief, there were moments when I couldn't see it, but I just said, well, I've got to get through this day. I've just got to keep, am I going to lie in bed, you know, hiding under the duvet and do nothing? Or am I at least going to try to be the master of my own destiny? You know, I can hide from my problems and do nothing, but that 100% leads to failure, right? Or I can get up, I can get dressed, I can go to the gym. That's really a crutch. I'm probably addicted to exercise as a result. Or you can get up and you can go and, you know, you can go and face the day and you can try, because I've already got losing. I only have a win to get out of today. That's the only, you know, if I do nothing, I've already lost. But if I get up and go, I could pull a win out of today. And I borrowed a lot from sports books and sports psychology and British cycling. I don't know if anyone likes cycling or road cycling. I read a wonderful book this idea of marginal gains, you know, oh, make the seat slightly comfier, get the guys to wash their hands a little bit more frequently so they're not sick as often, so they miss less training days, and, you know, make them travel with their pillows when they go so they sleep better because it feels more like at home. These marginal gains, right? And that's where that idea of do anything to make the business 1% better. And that's if that could even be somebody else giving me one of those cost-saving ideas of me just trying to implement it. You know, it could be done in half an hour. Sometimes it would take the whole day. But if you improve your business by 1% every day, and again, I'm stealing this from other people, there's 365 days in the year, you know, so that's over 3.5 times better now. Okay, there are holidays and all the rest of it. Even if you only did it for 300 days, 200 days, who cares? 100 days, 100% better than where you are right now is huge. And those benefits, you know, here we go, compounding, you know, eight wonder of the world. But those savings compound, you know, that I made in 2017, that's carrying forward that leanness that we build in, that carries forward that incentive that gets people to sell a little bit more that we keep repeating. That those things they carry forward as well. So those 1% gains, you don't feel them on day one. But if you keep playing the game, if you can keep, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul, take money from anywhere, whatever, you know, steal forward earnings from the future to make your accounts look better if you're trying to get a loan, you know, whatever it is that you need to do, but make it 1% better. Mm-hmm. Actually, that makes me smile. I did something that's a little unethical. But like Charlie said, the first 100 grand's a bitch, right? And whatever you need to do. When I was stuck for cash and when we were a little bit more on top of our accounts, often when you do a loan application to a bank or a lender, they do a check on your company, right? But if you submit two or three applications the same day, they'll all do the application and all of them will see that there are no other charges. They have a tendency not to check again. So I would say that that's probably unethical. But if you're in a business and you really, you know, I still signed the PGs for those loans, right? I was still on the hook, but I needed more money than people felt comfortable lending me. I just remember, because I needed more time.
Yeah.
But, you know, all those things that I wouldn't dream of now. But at the time, you know, when needs must, you find a way. But yeah, trying to do, you know, 1% better. And to me, getting those loans in was even counted, because as long as I thought we could pay them and if it gave us time. And then as we started to get on top of payments to our suppliers and things like that, I said, okay, well, you know, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, we were behind. Now we were always update. I would like, you know, 10 days instead of 0 days. And after a year of that, so, okay, I want 20 days, 30 days. And that's all building your cash flow, right? Because you have that 10-day lag. Suddenly you're building up cash. You never have to pay that. That lag just builds, right? And you can use that for other things. And then it's just wonderful how it snowballs from there. And before I knew it, I was sitting on money that I was like, oh, hang on, now I need to, you know, what was that Buffett guy whose book I read? yeah. Let me go back to that, right?
It's money.
Yeah. And for a long time, I wanted to, just give my money to someone and invest. And then the more I started getting into the space, and then, you know, podcasts were great on the tube or videos at night, you know, when my kids were up or my daughter was up at the time. So started watching stuff, discovered your channel, some other channels. And this idea, oh, hang on, if people are taking 2% for breathing, I think as Monish likes to put it, that's not a great deal. And I was like, oh, yeah, but I'm so busy and all the rest of it. And then I read The Outsiders. And I am in no way trying to infer that I'm anywhere near any of the CEOs in those books. But the light bulb moment happened that half of my job is actually capital allocation. And the idea that, you know, if I am not able to invest in the business directly, always, because we're very high end, you know, we're like RH plus a little bit. So there's like a limited market. So it's not like we need a shop in every town. And because, yeah, those opportunities weren't there, but it suddenly, that light bulb happened. And also what was lovely is that most of them were first-time CEOs, sometimes by accident.
Yeah.
And it made me, again, feel confident that maybe I could do this, could have a go. And then, you know, I started diving into more books, you know, started reading much more deeply, you know, went to Omaha, met these people, met fund managers, spoke to them and listen to their conversations. Oh, these are not demigods that have, you know, superpowers.
They're people, in fact, yeah.
Yeah. And phrases like, do your own research. It's not a disclaimer. It's an instruction. And you can do it. Read the footnotes. Read the annual reports. Don't read a summary. And it's wonderful. And by the way, for anyone listening, if you're wondering about my investment track record or something, I've certainly had losses and wins, and I've been lucky so far. I'm ahead overall over time, but still slightly lagging the S&P. Maybe I should just not be so arrogant and just buy the S&P. But I'm enjoying learning about it, and I'm doing a variety of different things. And exploring new places. And the record is quite short, right? So I've given myself 5 years to see if we can get, you know, good returns. And if not, I will let go of my vain position and simply give in to buying the index, I think.
Fair enough. Well, I want to get a lot more into the investing side of it shortly, because you've actually done a recent trip to Turkey, which will be quite interesting to a lot of the people watching as well. But just before we get into that, I mean, in terms of where the business is at today, you've obviously got some, you know, you're taking on some gnarly loans in the tough days there. It sounds like you're pretty well out the other side and even have some surplus cash, and you're looking at the investing stuff much more heavily again now. So tell us a little bit about what it was like kind of hopefully starting to feel really good again, climbing out of that hole. And I want you to share the boardroom table story if you can as well, which you'll know what I'm talking about.
So let's talk about the boardroom table first, and then I'll talk about the other side. So even though we don't really sell the furniture of my mother's family's factory so much anymore, we still do a little bit, but they're very much artisans. They do bespoke work, but they did a wonderful project for a very large technology company that can't be named, but will be familiar to every single listener.
I think you understated its size when you said it was very large. Probably need like three or four varies in the front of that word, but anyway.
Yeah, a large technology company. And, you know, they wanted this unique, beautiful wooden boardroom table, but they wanted it like in one whole piece without any additional legs, which is incredibly difficult to do, especially if you have to transport it from Europe across the Atlantic. You have the humidity, temperature, the risk of warping and stuff, and just from the structure and stuff. But they wanted these beautiful wooden boardroom table for their head office. And this is actually a very technically challenging. People are like, oh, it's just a table, right? Stick four legs on it and all the rest of it. But you have to go and select the tree, you know, and you have to think about these things and how it's, and even in the building, it had to be brought in before the building was complete, because obviously from Axis, it's this one massive piece. It was very, very difficult, because my cousin who runs it and designs these beautiful pieces of furniture is, you know, they're artisans. And, you know, commercially trying to work with, you know, a large technology company that has an army of lawyers that are trying to think about, you know, probably every risk bar nuclear war and like caveat. And so, which is why we can't name the company, because, you know, they're super strict on all of that, and, you know, documents this thick, and trying to help find a commercial way through those documents for a very small, very modest, you know, artisan factory in the Netherlands. Not only were we able to get through all of those things, it's really that my cousin and those guys that did really everything. Just the commerciality, you know, looking at some of those tombstones of legal documents, but they actually not only ended up doing the boardroom table, but they ended up doing parts of the cafeteria, some of the learning facilities, and a huge amount of follow-up work. And that was a fantastic contract for them, and just really exciting, really, really exciting to play with the big boys. As I like to say, I'm trained as a ski instructor. Which is risk management in a different way. If anyone enjoys skiing off piste, that was an amazing win to see how these small companies, how you can get those big wins out of it. And the boardroom table is fabulous, and it's a testament to their skill and their ability as craftsmen. You know, maybe there's a magazine called Wallpaper. Maybe if you go back several years, and you look at, you know, large headquarters of, you know, US tech companies, you might see some pictures of the headquarters. Yeah. It has a lot of wood furniture in it. Yes. And you could see if you could add those things together. Very cool. Yeah. They didn't pay in stock, which is a shame. That would have made it even better. Coming out the other side, what's strange is, and I still have this today, and I think it's in the book, The Psychology of Money, but like earning money is actually not necessarily the hardest thing. It's keeping it and maintaining that position. And so I would say that I probably border on slightly paranoid still. So I'm still, even though we're in a much better place today, and even when we came out of it, I'm still very mindful of costs. For example, I told you this year when I flew back from Omaha, I had a very early, I was landing in London 7 a.m. It was an overnight flight. And then I had to come into work. And then in the evening, I had to go up on to Scotland. And I flew business class, which the company can easily afford. You know, and I'm the managing director and, you know, we have some good stock position. I probably felt guilty most of the flight and for about 2 weeks afterwards because I thought, God, how much more did I spend on that? It was the first time in my life I'd done it. It was really exciting. I'd never done that. You know, normally I was like everyone else just in the back, right? But yeah, I felt guilty. I have booked economy return tickets this year to Omaha already to stop myself. But when we first started coming out the other side, first I would just log into the bank to see that there was actually like a positive, like a decent positive balance. And it took me a while to feel comfortable to pull the trigger. It took me a long time. My personal portfolio, I have things like Barber in, which we've spoken about and other things. So in my personal portfolio, I find it much easier to get comfortable with those kind of, you know, political risks or other things we might talk about, Turkey as well. In the company's portfolio, which is effectively, you know, I'm the steward. I have a fiduciary duty to my parents who are the shareholders, right, or to my family. I really, you know, think a lot more deeply. And which is ridiculous, right? I should do it just as well for both, but because it's not actually my money, I feel a much higher degree of care and maybe a bit more defensive is the wrong word, but you know, maybe I'm a little bit more a la Guy Spear than Monish Pabrai in that respect, which is odd because I'm in Turkey. But if anyone has ever heard those two investors speak, whereas in my personal account, maybe I'm a little bit more Monish-esque. In the sort of the flavor or the view that I take, or I come through it more easily. Oddly, my checklist is much shorter for my own portfolio whereas I really force myself to go through the written checklist for my family's or for the company's investments. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for a long time it was just building, and then feeling like okay. And then I was like, okay, we could shut, basically COVID could happen and without government support now we would be okay. And I was like, okay. That's. And I was like, okay, that's probably enough reserve.
I think we're
a result of our environment. I think that I'd felt very much under the pump for such a long time that I was just paranoid that this can't last, something's gonna go wrong, you know. I was so used to new things coming out. So I think short term, I'm an incredible pessimist. Long term, I'm an optimist. So I'm really worried about what's happening tomorrow or next week. But I generally feel good over the next 5 years, which is quite a contrasting way to go through life.
It's probably a good place to be honest.
But yeah, if we can save money and it doesn't hurt our long term prospects for 5 years from now, then I'll probably choose to do that.
Well, shall we I wonder if we transition into the investment side a little bit. It's kind of become like this running joke on sometimes on the podcast or on Punch Card Investing that whenever we have Jason after an investor on, he'll always talk about these high level people that, you know, are giving him all this information and there's actually an array of high level people, I should say, just full transparency. But Digby, you're actually the first high-level person we've revealed because you did a recent trip to Turkey to, I guess, look for some deep value stocks. So a couple of questions on that, maybe just to get us started on the investing stuff. Firstly, do you want to just give us you know, kind of a couple of sentences on your general investment framework. I imagine it's probably quite similar to a lot of the people watching, but just so people can get a feel for that. And then I guess what drew you to Turkey and what was the...
Just for that trip. So I do use a calculator. I'm not as clever as Warren or Charlie, I'm afraid. But I am not somebody that is spreadsheet heavy or even like super complicated discounted cash flow. I'm, you know, from my own experience, I just want to see, you know, what's the free cash flow at the moment? What's it like? And is there a lot of debt? And for the rest, I'm much more Phil Fisher. That's kind of my, happy place when I look at companies, kind of doing that sort of scuttlebutt work. The product, the people that work there, those are real factors that I can get into. And then I'm very fortunate, as I said, I met two people at Omaha who I'm in, you know, almost daily contact with, that we bounce ideas off. And I think that's a wonderful way to work. You know, I still don't know what they see that they get out of talking to me, but I get a lot out of talking to them and sending them stuff, and they, you know, save me from my worst ideas. And all three of us went to Turkey. My investing framework, I kind of am looking for a 10x10 portfolio at cost. I won't get into reasons why. I think a lot of people watching will have an idea as to why that concentration is useful. Everyone will have their own flavor. Sometimes I take a double position. You know, there are no hard and fast rules. Sometimes, a la Guy Spier, I will take a small 2% opening position and see how I feel. But, you know, somewhere in there, it was kind of this idea of 10 by 10. And then I do also work with some funds that have, you know, more like a Buffett style. You know, they take a fee if they're successful, because I feel like I have limited time and they will have an edge over me that will be insurmountable. We'll talk about it later, but Turkey's a good example, actually, of where that's very clear to me. What drew me to Turkey? Firstly, I heard Monish talking about it, like, hands down. You know, if he hadn't been talking about it, it probably wouldn't have flagged as quickly onto my radar. Then I heard Matthew Peterson talk about it. I was like, two, okay. And then I started to do some research. I found the Talos Fund, which Matthew Peterson also runs, or is in his fund, and is actually run by Mesut in Turkey, but is, you know, managed by Peterson Capital Management. And, you know, if you send them a nice email, they'll give you a password and you can read some letters. And so start reading these letters, start reading about these companies, start looking at some metrics and going, hey, you know, these sounds pretty interesting. So, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I have enough liquidity that I could take a position in Talos, for example, based on their minimum investment. So set up a call with Matthew, set up a call with Mesut, talk to these guys. Hey, these are interesting guys. I feel like they know what they're talking about. Mesut has a wonderful history. And then it's okay, I want to go to Turkey because, you know, Phil Fisher, you know, what are you going to do? You kind of see it, touch it, be there, right? It's I'm much better at that. You know, I'm not a very smart investor. Maybe like Peter Lynch, right? If you're in Dunkin' Donuts every day in the line and you see, you know, those are the kind of cues for me, the work. Or Alain Monish, when he talked about monopolies of airports. Now every time I walk through an airport, I'm like, oh my God, how did I not see that? And I'm looking around, I'm going, this is so obvious, right? And I'm looking at the price of the food and the drink. But see, I'm there and I'm seeing and I'm doing it and I'm seeing how quickly people go through security, how busy the shops are. And those kind of things are quite important to me, that you won't necessarily get in an analyst report, right? So we go over there, and again, the two guys, I'm not sure if they want to be named, who I met at Omaha, but, you know, we were talking about it, and then we said, well, let's go to Turkey. And one of them really, really wanted to see Reşas, and he's not a US investor. So he'd even set up a US LLP, to be able to then open a brokerage account. He's brought himself into the US tax system, done all of, you know, he's super keen. And we were all keen, and I was emailing with Mesut, and Mesut set up a couple of meetings. But we then also set up some meetings with Reşas and Tav, which are not companies that Mesut, I can't say a surname, I don't want to butcher it, but if you go for Talos, the Talos Fund, and Mesut, who runs it, you know, you'll know who I'm talking about, and I can't praise him enough. Reishas, you know, we all know what I mean, wouldn't he actually give us a meeting? And then we said, we're coming with Masoud. And he's like been studying the whole Turkish market for like, you know, 20, 30 years, everybody, all of a sudden the door was open. So super grateful again, we were very lucky. And then we went there, and of course he recommended like the Conrad, like a really nice hotel in Istanbul. And I was like, wow, that's really expensive. So I just got some embarrassingly cheap hotel opposite. And I think he was a bit confused when I told him, because he's like, I thought these were serious investors and we're staying in some like unbranded kind of, you know, perfectly okay. It's clean and, but you know, hasn't been updated in 30 years. I think somebody had been smoking in the room before.
He should know that if you've been following Buffett and Munger along, if you stay in the cheap hotel across the street, that means you're even more serious of an investor, I would say.
Well, then he said, shall I arrange a chauffeur to get us around? And I was like, no, we'll just take Uber. You know, so, and I think he felt like a bit, because he's such a great host, he was like, no, then I will drive you. I will drive you. And actually that was a stupid mistake, because it meant that he was, you know, focused on driving, getting us to the meetings on time, and we missed some great debrief time. So actually that was a false economy that I missed. And in hindsight, I shouldn't repeat. So Manish got me interested. Then I heard Matt talk about it. Then I spoke to Masoud, and then also with the other guys. And, you know, we were looking at Tav, we were looking at Aishas, and I'd been reading the letters of Talas. And I was personally very interested in Arçelik, which they make like washing machines, dishwashers, all those kind of things, because I know their products in the UK, Beko, they're number one. And obviously we have this situation where the lira is in a free fall. And if your labor costs are in lira, but your main revenues are in pounds and euros, because you're a very dominant supplier or even number one market position in the UK, which is a decent market for appliances, then you've got like hard, you know, good hard currency revenues coming in. I will say that they do have to also buy from overseas, because Turkey doesn't have like a lot of minerals. So they're buying in the raw materials, but still the labor, some of the debt. Now, this idea that all Turkish companies have lira debt is not necessarily true, because the banks are not crazy either, right? They can see what's happening with the lira. So a lot of it is euro denominated debt as well, right? But anyway, more than interesting enough to go on a trip. And, you know, Masoud was delighted to host us. And he basically, Monday to Friday, a week of this guy's time, right? And as much as I am an accredited investor, or I can afford to invest, you know, I am not putting millions of dollars into Turkey. Nobody should be under the illusion. I am definitely like the minnow in the Talas fund. You know, I appreciate that for some viewers and listeners, the benchmark, I think, is $100,000, something like that, $150,000. I can't remember off the top of my head, but you know, which for me is just about dollars to pounds, is probably a 5 to 7% position of the portfolio, right? So, and we'll talk about risk in Turkey and why, but is accessible to me. But I am definitely, I think there's only like 10 people in the Talas fund, and if we look at the size of the fund, I'm definitely the only person that was like trying to scrape in at the minimum threshold, like, you know, and for him to still want to spend a whole week, and the other two guys aren't even invested. And I said, can I bring these guys along? Can we go to these other companies? Wonderful. So we were really excited. Deep value, Turkey, all of this. The number one thing I learned in Turkey is that it is beggar's belief that you could outperform Masoud in Turkey. The hidden value is him and his knowledge. It's just, he is so very knowledgeable about all of the companies, about the history, about the people. I mean, we were at a large insurance company at Anadolu Hayat, and they're explaining the business model and the revenue, and I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And then he points out, we're there with a vice president and like the financial controller and the investment relations. And then he points out a couple of hundred million on their balance sheet of real estate towers that they've sort of forgotten about, that are also there, like as extra, like he's explaining to the vice president and like to them their own balance sheet better than they are able to explain it to us, which is like a you know, the level of detail and when they were last valued and all of these things is very good. And I, you know, he's also a family man, a wonderfully genuine person. You know, like you know, Munger and Buffett always talk about, you know, working with the right people. And that counts a lot. And there's no way that I could have that, you know, without having been to Turkey and having seen that. I'm really happy that I'm able to be in Talos, because I think that for me, that's the best way that I'm going to be successful in Turkey, because the level of knowledge that Masut has, I don't think that I could have an edge over Masut, for me personally. Other people would need to make up their own minds as to the best way, if they want to invest in Turkey. Mm. It also means that you don't have to mess around with ADRs and things like that. So it can also make it more accessible.
Yep. Cool. Well, should we, I wonder if we jump to Twitter even. I collected some questions over on Twitter. I said we had a high level person coming on the podcast, guys, so give us all your Turkey questions, and we've got a few kind of on specific companies and stuff. I know some of these you visited, some you may not be familiar with, but I'll throw them at you, and if you got thoughts, feel free to share. All right, quick break there, Digby. We just had to you got booted out of your meeting room there, but we'll continue on here. So this first question from Twitter, this is from Lunch at Lunch Investing. I believe in Turkey you can find Munger-esque businesses at Graham prices, as Monish once said. Highest quality of companies at low single digits. If you don't mind giving names, which companies interest you the most? Races, Tab, CCI, etc.
Yeah, sure. So as you have poor Charlie's almanac there behind you, and I think that he gives a wonderful example as to why Coca-Cola is such a great business. I think CCI for me is definitely one of those businesses that has those wonderful qualities. I think everybody would understand the power of the brand, pricing power, recognition. And it's the cheapest Coke bottler in the world. And it's not just limited to Turkey. They're actually have Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan. I think it's Iran or Iraq. They have a huge amount of other places that they supply as well, and have the rights to. Also, it's a very modern company for Turkey. The office could be in a, you know, second European city. It could be sat in Rotterdam. They have a lovely inclusivity statement. It feels very modern and progressive, and with a very young working culture that might want to go overseas. I could imagine that it's an attractive place to have on your CV and an attractive place to work. Bear in mind, it's still also quite a religious country. So having that, yeah, very modern, you know, Western values, I could see as being appealing. So good talent, larger market than just Turkey. And also Coke Atlanta doesn't charge a fixed dollar fee for the syrup. They take a percentage of revenues. They're taking the FX risk with them. There's also low penetration of soft drinks and single serve packaged drinks in Turkey, in Uzbekistan, which both have very young population. And the average price per serve is low. And in fact, international other bottlers from Europe and stuff that are not used to inflation came to ask their Turkish counterparts how to deal with inflation, because they're used to doing that. I get very regular updates. It feels very slick. They knew what they were talking about. And it's a brand that we all know, right? And if you could buy a Coke bottler at single-digit PE, there is this story of Turkey and some of the other markets, but, you know, Coke Atlanta is also divesting from their South Asian markets. You know, Singapore is one they may be looking to get out of. India is one they may, you know, and CCI in Turkey took over Pakistan recently from Atlanta. You know, the population is huge, the penetration is very low, and the brand recognition is, you know, is it the most recognized brand in the world? So I definitely think that the valuation is low. There is a reason for that. And I think that the quality is super high. So I think that in terms of that question, CCI is probably the best example of that. Maybe not the most sexy name out there in terms of, you know, hype and, you know, but sometimes you want a boring company. What do you do? Soft drinks. It's Coca-Cola.
Okay, right, Digby, we've just moved to the next location, but let's talk about the next company. And I should say, you just wanted to assure the viewers that that's not your house. You're not living in this nice office.
No, I live in London. I live in Northeast London, and my flat is 62 square meters, and I have two children. So it's certainly not as decadent or as spacious as this. I'm actually sat in the showroom now because unfortunately we had to move because clients come first. We still got to get those orders in, and they needed a private meeting room to conclude a transaction. So.
Love it. Well, let's maybe move to you pronounce it far better than me, but Racist Logistics. I believe that's yeah. been visited, right? It's one of the more talked about Turkish stocks in the
yeah. region. I went to Reishash, I think it's pronounced, and I met with the CFO, the head of investor relations, who doesn't speak any English. The CFO used to be in investor relations, and I also got to speak to the father son team, the son by telephone. Whilst we're there and have a quick tour of the headquarters, which are very nice and impressive buildings built in a kind of a villa style overlooking parts of the city near the motorway. For one of the other guys on the trip, that was the company that he was most excited about visiting. And I think I said before, but maybe you have to cut it because I had to move locations. So he actually set up an LLC or LLP in the US just so that he could have an account with Fidelity, just so that he could buy that stock. So very excited. And do you know what? I think that it's a very fast growing company. It's super interesting. They've done a lot of wonderful things. Absolutely. But for me, I was not able to see the $1.5 billion valuation based on their own filed or their own accounts that you can see on their website. And there's the REIT, there's the main business. And you know, that was also a little bit more confusing for me. And it just wasn't as obviously wonderful to me as, you know, CCI, that was very simple. But then again, I'm not that smart a person, right? I sell tables and chairs. I didn't study business or economics or investing. And so it's definitely fast growing, but they use debt. There's a rights issue going on right now. So if you don't want to be diluted, you need to put more money in. And that's not the first time that they've done that. And so there's a lot going on with the financials, and that's harder for me to gauge. Whereas, you know, will people buy Coca-Cola tomorrow? Yeah. Will they drink bottled water? Yeah. Will energy drink, you know, will the market for energy drinks continue to rise in those emerging markets, similar to the way that it has in other places? I don't know, but probably, yeah. You know, I can feel, and there's just a lot more going on. And, you know, I may miss out on that, you know, the 100 bagger, and, you know, I will look back at this and go, oh God, you, what were you doing? But that's okay, because I'm not smart enough for it to be 100% clear. And so whereas CCI and some of the other companies were wonderful, wonderfully clear to me, it was, you know, couldn't miss. And like I said, I'm just at the start of my journey. You know, I don't have a track record like Monish or Guy or Charlie or Warren. So it's likely that I can't see things that they can see. But, you know, cloning and understanding, I think, is important. I think Monish would agree that if I can't see it, then that's the right decision for me. And I don't think that I should succumb to the pressure to pretend I can see it if I can't really. Mm-hmm. Might kick myself in 10 years for saying that. But.
Well, we'll see. It's on the internet now, so it's there forever. But you can always come back and look at it.
Look, it's a rapidly growing business. Yeah. You know, all of the things that they try their hand at, they have been successful at. But the rights issue and the debt and the fact that it's split into these two, and a lot of the recent price appreciation has been the revaluation of real estate. And I'm not sure how to think about the real estate market in Turkey. You know, whereas some of the other businesses, either their overseas revenues in hard currency, and they were just simpler to understand, much simpler for me to understand. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope everybody, you know, does really, really well out of Racist, and maybe they can buy me a drink in commiseration, saying, yeah, oh, you're the guy that you were there and you didn't do it.
But
I sleep okay at night with the positions that I have in Turkey, and that's what counts for me.
Yeah, I think Jason owes you a couple of drinks from those late night phone calls he was getting from Turkey from you, maybe. He was very Jason, grateful for those.
Yeah, Jason, I have a Racist mug on my desk that I drink my coffee out of, and I take my super investor sip. And I love the content that Jason puts out. I love that he, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very happy to put things out, even if they're unpopular. I sent him a message actually recently because I saw Carvana popped and I was like, hey, congrats. I'm super happy for you. I know that's a controversial one. I wish everybody success. And I'm happy to share the information. When I asked for help in business, lots of people were really generous. I was very happy that I could share that information with you and with Jason, because that's, you know, it's a nice thing to do. You put a lot of nice information out there free of charge for people to, you know, it's entertainment, but also educational. So I was happy to share that, but it wasn't one for me. I think, Tav, a really cool company, really nice to visit them as well. Anadolu Hayat, Arçelik, I really like. I know it's really boring, right? They make washing machines, who cares? But if your washing machine breaks, you're going to buy a new one. and they have a dominant position in Europe. You know, they've done a JV with Whirlpool. They have lower costs, so higher margins supplying Europe. And also, when Whirlpool US was desperate to exit Russia, the investor relation guys, they were like, look, we can't tell you the price. You know, that's not our place to do. And we said, well, was it cheap, right? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, well, how cheap? Like, and there was a wry smile. And he went, it was really cheap. You know, so they got those assets as well. I don't know how people feel about, you know, a company that has some assets in Russia, but Turkey and Russia still have a relatively good trading relationship. Those people still need washing machines. You know, regardless of what the leadership is doing in the country, you know, ordinary people, you know, may or may not agree. I can't speculate on that, but I feel okay having my money in Arçelik, knowing that they supply, you know, hygiene, you know, cleaning machines in or own assets in the Russian market. I think that's really interesting. Some of the automotive companies were interesting. There are a bunch of ADRs that people can buy. If you're not in the US, I'm pretty sure that if you were to Google investing equities, Turkey ADRs, they'd probably, you know, there's several that come up. CCI doesn't have one, but Anadolu Efes, I think, Anadolu Efes, which is a big shareholder. But you would need to look at that company because they own it, obviously. So there's like the holding, well, they're a business in their own right. That also have a drinks activity, but they're also a big shareholder. So that would be one way if people are interested. If they're not in the US, they can't get through Fidelity. But you would need to do the work, on CCI and on Anadolu Efes if that's of interest. But there are ways if you feel comfortable having a position in Turkey. And it's certainly a small position for me. I'm very excited about it. I think it's great. Do I think it's going to triple in a year or two? No. But over the long term, do I think it could do really, really well? Yeah, that's why I'm there.
Yeah. But like you say, it comes with its own set of risks. And I think you're taking the Guy Spear, like water to the ankles or something. Where's the water up to with Turkey for you?
It's probably a bit lower. I think... Here I go. I told you before, I'm a sucker for the macro and I always try to pull over. I love the Financial Times on the weekend, right? I try to stay away from the news cycle in the week a little bit, but on the weekends, you know, I love the FT. My kids often wake me up very early. So try and read a bit of that. But, you know, they've recently, their finance minister, they've reappointed this guy that was educated in the UK, used to work for Merrill Lynch. He was previously the finance minister and has a much more orthodox view. The new head of the central bank, you know, is educated in the US, used to work at Goldman Sachs and First Republic. I think Fortune featured her as one of 40 under 40 CEOs or top managers at banks, the only woman on the list at the time. Like, these are people that have a much more traditional orthodox view, that have a good track record, that, you know, would resonate well with international investors. Will the government allow them to make the radical changes that are needed in full? Who knows? You know, I'd love to know, but I can't know. Is it an easy task? No, they can't just crank rates and kill the availability of credit either. You know, so it's difficult. It will take years. But I think that those are the right people. If there were people that could be there that were going to make those changes, I think those are the right ones. But again, here I am getting into macro. So maybe it was up to my knees and now it's up to my shins. I feel a little bit better about the idea that they are making changes. The interest rate has gone up, not by enough. But yeah, and, you know, I walked around Istanbul And we laughed. People have been walking those streets for, you know, hundreds of years doing business. You know, 1,000 years ago, it was a hub. You know, will it be a hub 1,000 years from now? No idea. But it certainly felt, it certainly feels, you know, very reassuring. And the young population, there's a lot of energy, a lot of dynamism. And, you know, big caveat, I've only seen Istanbul. I'm invested in Turkey. I have a massive bias, obviously, because I've made that commitment in my mind. Massive confirmation bias, probably. So people should 100% take this with a pinch of salt.
Yep.
But yeah, I sleep well at night with my position size.
Yeah, I really appreciate the thoughts. I really appreciate the thoughts, Toby. It's rare for someone to own international stocks and actually travel to their country and do the work if you're not like some enormous institutional investor. So it's very cool to be able to do that trip and share it.
Yeah, I think the guy that was visiting after me was the largest in the fund, and you know, $10 million or something. You know, and I was being afforded the same. The same treatment, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a testament to Masoud and to Matt and the people, you know, Matt for finding Masoud and who they choose to work with. I think they originally met at ValueX. So, you know, Guy Spear again, connecting the people. I really think Guy should get a medal for all of the effort that he puts into connecting people in these different events and some of the events that he's put on, just the two at Omaha, the quality of the people I've met, and I've been, you know, I don't pay for it. It's incredibly generous what he gives back. So anyone listening that's thinking on the fence about Omaha, I can't endorse it highly enough.
For sure. Yeah. Well, that was actually going to be my final question here, Digby. I really, really appreciate you sharing all that you've shared on this episode, both about the business, some of the struggles, the success stories, but also the Turkey trip as well. My final question for you was actually going to be, I know the answer to the first part of this, but are you planning to be back at Berkshire next year? And secondly, what are you most looking forward to? Is it the 100-year-old Charlie at the meeting, or what do you most look forward to at the Berkshire weekend these days?
Yes. As I left the hotel this year, the last thing I did was book my room for next year. And I've already bought my tickets. What am I most looking forward to? There are so many things that I look forward to. This year, bumped into Bill Gates. He walked past me whilst I was having breakfast. That's weird. whilst I was having breakfast, actually, with Johan and Daniel from Technion, so the chief investment officer and the CEO, and that was really good. I think seeing my friends again that I met there the first time I saw them there this year, that's one of the things that I really look forward to. And seeing 100-year-old Charlie, just, I'm so much in awe that at that age, you know, we can see the degradation of age. They're slower. Sometimes they forget a little bit of the question. But you say, oh, in 1962, when this happened, it reminds me. It's like, wow, the recall and the clarity and the quality of those responses to do that for 4 hours, I'm in awe of. You know, when I think about my own ability to concentrate and, you know, I think that's amazing to see. But what I think what I really look forward to is the other people that I meet. That's so enriching for me. And, you know, one day they'll discover that I'm the stupidest person in the room and they'll stop talking to me. But for now, I'm managing to fly under the radar, a nice tie, good suit, and they must think this guy knows something. So I'll go with that for now.
Yep. You never fail to undersell yourself, Digby, but... I'm very much looking forward to catching up with you again in Omaha next year. It's been a lot of fun, so I really appreciate you having on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in person again stateside.
Absolutely.